All right. Welcome back to Drummer Nation Live. I'm going to give this a second to get rolling and show up on our platforms, but I've dispensed with some of the usual introductory stuff in honor of my wonderful guest, one of the most popular people in the drum industry, one of the most well-known, friend to all, not a negative word about him, my buddy, John DeChristopher. Welcome, John. How are you?
Well, thank you so much for that intro, Michael. I'm doing really great. Thank you. How are you doing?
Well, I'll get us out of that box. I'm fine. I'm good. So where are you?
I am in my drum room at my house in Cohasset, Massachusetts. It's a beautiful late summer day here. Just had my lunch outside on the deck. I was just before we got together, I was playing for about an hour and a half. So that was cool.
It's real pretty here, too. I just came back from camping, so I'm a little rusty here with my switching, so I'm trying to minimize it. But you and I have a lot in common. I mean, first of all, for anybody who doesn't know, John DeChristopher was the artist relations guy at Zildjian for how many years?
24 years, just shy of it, a couple months shy of 24 years.
Right. And mentored with the great Lenny DeMuzio, would you say?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. Spent a lot of time with Lenny.
Lenny's kind of credited with starting the whole artist relations thing many years ago.
Lenny set the bar high, we sort of joke about, which bar we're talking about, but I'm talking about, not the bar where you and I used to meet at PASIC, but but the bar, coming into Zildjian, I'll just say, I knew Lenny for many years before I started working there. So I had the greatest respect and love for him. And, I was lucky to work there for, of the 24 years that I worked there, 14 were with Lenny and Armin Zildjian. And, Armin sadly passed at the end of 2002 and Lenny moved on at the beginning of 2003. But it was a magical time to be around those guys. And
absolutely.
Lenny was a definitely a friend and a mentor.
Well, to me as well. I want to talk some about all the, not only the artists you know and interacted with, but all the industry people too, because there's like two sides of that. But first, let's talk a little bit about artist relations. It exploded over in the 70s and 80s and maybe even in the 90s. What do you think, how does it stand now? What do you think do you think that artist relations programs are a little bloated sometimes?
Well, my sense, Michael, is that I've been gone now close to 10 years. And I think in that time, it seems companies have made more of an effort to sort of trim the fat, but just to streamline it. That's probably a better way of saying it. Certainly, I'll admit that when I was there, it was a different time. And, the business was different. I dare say it was a more robust business. Certainly at a point, the business that we were doing warranted I had a large staff of people that worked for me, and we needed that many people to cover the different offices in Los Angeles and London and, clinic tours and things that we were doing that warranted having a staff of myself and some managers that worked for me and some other people in the offices. So, but to your point, it became, I think, as things changed in the industry, that part of the business changed. And I've seen it kind of shrink a little bit. I think companies are maybe a little less liberal than they used to be with product. That sort of thing. I mean, I've sort of heard that from artists and it's the way it goes. As things change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been out 7 years, I guess, now as well. Yeah. A lot of things in the industry have changed. One of the things when it comes to endorsing artists, there's kind of a dichotomy there in that some of the best drummers in the world play to very small audiences. You're a jazz musician and you've got 80 people in a room and they're all going crazy, that's a wonderful full room packed house. But there may only be four drummers in the room. On the other hand, you have artists out there who play stadiums, sheds, giant venues, and they perform in front of all kinds of tens of thousands of people a night, but they may not have the same cred as some of the artists that don't have a lot of exposure. So you kind of have to balance those two, don't you?
You really do. That's, you put it really well. I mean, that was always a challenge for me was, looking at the exact situation that you said, you go into a local club here in Boston, the Regatta Bar, and and I would say that like on certain nights when if it were Brian Blade playing or Bill Stewart or Dave Weckl or Dennis Chambers, any of the real, influencers, you'd have a room full of Berkeley drummers at the gig. And so you had your target audience in the room, and it was definitely a captive audience when it came to that. But it, like as you say, it might only be 100 people. But I always felt that those drummers were so valuable because they're speaking to that, high end, in the case of Zildjian, the K Zildjian top of the line cymbal market that we'd be trying to reach. And those were the drummers that could best expose those products, both best promote those products. So to me, it was well worth it having drummers of that ilk,
Yeah,
representing
absolutely.
the company.
That's my point. I saw part of your interview from a while back with Don Lombardi yesterday, and he was talking about a time in Buddy's life, Buddy Rich, when he was one of those guys, arguably maybe the greatest drummer who ever lived, depending on who you're talking to, certainly top of the top of the top. And there were some companies that weren't really interested at the time because he played small rooms at a time when stadiums were exploding.
I know. I remember, thank you for mentioning that. We did that in June of 2021, and I reposted it just in light of this exciting news in the industry. But I remember Don telling me this when I worked for him. I worked for him before Zildjian for a few years, and he had told me that story before, and I found it sort of fascinating and shocking at the same time that Buddy was still Buddy. I mean, Buddy's been gone, rest his soul, for 35 years, and he may not be as influential as he was in the 70s and maybe the 80s, but he's still, I think, like John Bonham, there's this his legacy carries on, so to speak. Buddy lives on in YouTube, and you see the phenomenal musician that he was, so anyway, to your point, I found that not surprising, but at the same time, that was kind of the direction that the business was going in at that time. I was working in retail in the 80s when the Japanese companies were really coming on strong, and they were very smart the way they targeted a lot of, young up and coming rock drummers. Simon Phillips, for example, was a young drummer, maybe not so much up and coming, but he was one of the early faces of Tama drums, in the late 70s. And he was a Stuart Copeland, in the early 80s. And these guys went on to become hugely influential at that time and sold, I hope I can say it, a shit ton of drums,
Yeah,
during that time.
shit ton of records too.
Shit ton of records, yeah. I remember those days too, like seeing the American companies just, Slingerland and Rodgers especially, just kind of disappear. Ludwig and Gretsch were able to sort of hang in there by the skin of their teeth, but you had Tama and Yamaha and Pearl just really come in, and at the they kind of saw all the openings and all the weaknesses that had been there from the American drum companies, and seized those opportunities.
Well, they were also part of giant corporations too.
True. Yep.
One
True.
of the things that surprised me when I got into the industry is how small these companies really are. I mean, Zildjian, to their credit, is the big dog and has been all through this while the drum companies went through phases. But there are grocery stores that gross $1 million a week.
Right. Oh, I know. I know. Yeah, I
And that's
know.
probably more than any of the drum or cymbal companies do. And that's a single grocery store. So
Yeah,
that's no
yeah.
slight on those companies. That's just saying that this is a very small industry.
Exactly. And I used to, people, I think you and I can relate to this, where there's this assumption that the drum industry is, $100 billion or 50, it's a much smaller number than what people think. And I think with that, they think a company like Zildjian is, a quarter of $1 billion, and DW is that same amount. And there's this whole sort of warped kind of view of how big the industry really is, or really how small it is.
Well, they're on TV. They're on major stages. They're in movies. It's part of the fabric of all of our lives is
Yeah.
music. So we tend to think of it as a lot larger than it really is.
True. That's true. And I used to have conversations with people that, kind of assumed that we paid artists hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you probably had these conversations too, when you had Bosphorus, where people assume that Jeff Hamilton or Stanton Moore or any one of your top guys was getting a 5 or 6 figure salary or compensation, and
Let's
they just
dispel
don't
that
have an
myth
understanding.
right now. Yeah,
Yeah,
let's
dispel it
dispel
right
that
now.
myth. I remember I was at a clinic with one of our artists, and the question came up from a kid was, "Do you just get free stuff, or is there money too?" And your first response is, and that's when I shot him, Your Honor. But you really can't blame the guy because that's his perception. That's what
Yeah.
he thinks is an adequate question. He wasn't trying to be disrespectful or flippant.
No. It's like that old joke, like, do you get free, do you get free, just free stuff or money too? It's like that old, when did you stop beating your wife question? There's no right answer in there.
Can't win that
There,
one.
no, you can't win that one.
Yeah,
So, but I,
just
yeah, I think I was gonna say, I've heard you do interviews, and I've heard you talk about this, and you've, always tried to set people straight, as I have, and hopefully we're setting people straight right now on that
hope so,
part of it.
especially now that there's some contraction and consolidation in the industry. It's probably the endorsement thing is sort of waning, I think. Let me ask you another question. Now that
Sure.
the clinics have sort of, I won't say come and gone, but they're not as popular as they used to be, and social media is taking off, I think it's just a matter of time before part of an artist contract with an endorsing deal is to create social media about them and that company, or some kind of, could be almost anything, but
Sure,
that
yeah.
the companies are going to start to look for their social media content to be coming from the artists they sign, as well as the performances.
And I don't know. It may already be that. I can't speak for any companies that and I can't say that I know that, but
Well, I
I think
can't
it's a
either.
good point. Yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm just, that's a guess on my part. I'm out of it. So let's talk about some of the great artist you were fortunate to work with. We mentioned Buddy Rich, Louie Belson, I'm gonna throw out some of the older jazz cats, Max Roach. Any comments on those kind of guys?
I didn't get to work with Buddy, and that he passed away. I was working for DW at that time when he
Okay.
died in 1987, but I knew Louie Belson really well. I was very close with Louie, and I would just echo what the entire rest of the world says about Louie, which, besides being the incredible drummer,
I know
yeah,
what you're
that he
going to say,
was.
peach of a gentleman.
Oh my God! I mean, just the greatest. We were just talking about him, my son and I, recently. And a quick story: when my son
Please.
was, yeah, he was. So this would be 1993. Louis did a drum clinic at DiCenzo's Drum Shop here in Boston, Quincy, Massachusetts. And my son at the time would have been 6 years old. And it was a Sunday night, and I would have my kids on the weekends, and I kept them late that particular Sunday because I wanted my son and my daughter to see Louis Belson, meet Louis. So I'd spoken with Louis on the phone that day, and I said, I'll see you at the clinic. I'll get there at whatever time. So anyway, my son drew this picture. He was into drawing at the time. It's just funny now because his 7-year-old daughter, my granddaughter Fiona, does the same thing, but and my grandson Dylan. But anyway, so he drew this picture and came up on stage and gave the picture to Louis. And there's a YouTube of it, and Louis's saying, this is John's son, and he made this picture for me. And so that was beautiful in and of itself. For years after that, Michael, I'd be on the phone with Louis, and he'd say, John, you remember his voice. He'd say, John, I still have your son. How's your son doing? How's your boy? And I'd say, he's great, Louis. He's great. He's 12 now, or something. He'd say, well, tell him I said hello, and tell him I still have that picture. I keep it with me whenever I travel. One time at the Modern Drummer Festival, I had to go up to his room for a minute. I think it was before the banquet, and I had to go up and bring something to him. Pulls it out of his suitcase and shows it to me. I wanted to cry. I mean, he was just that kind of guy. Amazing. Max Roach, I got to know a little bit toward the end of Max's life, and that was just a thrill to just be in his presence, and you know, he had this way about him, this just the same feeling you get from like Roy Haynes, this just cool, it's Max Roach, just soak it all in, and you know, yeah.
How about a few of the other
Anyway.
classic jazz players? I know you knew Elvin.
Yeah. Same with Elvin. I was fortunate to know Elvin for like the last, you know, really well for like the last 10 years of his life, and spend time in his apartment in New York. And you know, these are things that, you know, as a kid, you'd never even imagine possible. I'd see these guys in the cover of magazines and would have never imagined that I'd know them, meet them, let alone know them and be their friend. And just an amazing soul.
I'm throwing out first names kind of guys here. Tony.
Tony, Tony was the first Zildjian artist drumstick that we made, artist series drumstick in
Remember that.
1990. You remember that? And that was that. I'd met Tony in 1982 when I was working at Wurlitzer Music, and he did a drum clinic there. He didn't really remember that all those years later, but when I got to know Tony around 1989, 1990, we became very close friends. I traveled on his one and only clinic tour in the fall of 96, just a few months before he passed away. And we had a blast, you know, for 2 weeks traveling the country, and he was just a, you know, just a blast to be around and just to see him play every night. And
Yeah, I have some experiences like that with other artists, and you just have to pinch yourself sometimes, right? You just can't believe that you're that lucky to be there and part of that. That's how I always felt. Now, you always also
Absolutely.
had, I know you were tight with rock and roll royalty. Did you know and work with Ringo at all?
Yes, I worked with Ringo quite a bit. I don't know Ringo as well as I knew Charlie, in that just we just Charlie and I just happened to have this relationship where he just you know, he liked me, and we really had this much tighter connection. But Ringo, you know, Ringo's Ringo, and I used to always say he's a Beatle. So if I go see him play, and he only has 3 minutes to say hello, I'm, you know, that's okay with me because he's Ringo. But I, you know, I have some great memories of him joking around at gigs. I brought him some cymbals one time. This would have been maybe the late 90s. His drum tech, Jeff Jonas, asked me to bring him a different ride cymbal. He was looking for something with a little bit more stick sound than what he'd been using, but still with a warm sound. And I think we had just come out with the K-Con big band cymbal. And I remember picking one out and going, well, I think, you know, I think this might work okay. And so I brought it to him, and he ended up using it for a while, but I brought it to him, and it was one of the few times that we were together behind his drums before the gig, and he actually put it up to try it, and he's playing it, and I'm just standing back. This is before Greg was in the band. So I'm just sort of standing back with Jeff Jonas, and I'm watching him, and he's you know, got this look in his face. He's kind of like, you know, trying it and then listening to it, playing the bell a little bit. And he turned to me and he said, you know, I used to have some really nice paste cymbals. Those were really nice. And he's, you know, he was just winding me up. He was just
Yeah,
wanted
right.
me, you know, just wanted to just take the piss out of the Zildjian guy that he used to play, you know, old Paiste 602s. So I turned around and I said, Ringo, I've heard that. What were they and when? Like, what records? And he, you know, he didn't expect that answer. He went like, oh God, John, I don't remember, you know, or something like
Doesn't
that.
remember. You know Gary Astridge, who's one of
Oh yeah.
he's kind of a new guy on the scene, who's he got his Ringo's Beatles kits, and he's Ringo's curator, and he's the guy Ringo asks. You know, when I
Yes.
did this tour, what tom-tom did I have there? And he knows, he's got all that, but yeah, he's a great guy too.
Gary's great. Yeah, he's
And
I'll
Charlie
just
Watts, Keltner, I mean, you got to
yeah.
be pinching yourself with those guys, man. They're a handful of drummers in the world in that league. And there you were interacting with them on a normal day-to-day basis. Now, one question is, people may not realize, but you pick out cymbals for these guys a lot, right?
I did. Yeah, in my certainly in my early years at Zildjian, you know, it was just a handful of us. I say a handful, but it was a small staff in those days. I mean, it was Lenny, myself, Colin Schofield. It was before John King, who later came to work in education, had been he was working in the factory for years, and we sort of brought him up into and to the marketing team. But you know, I would go down, I'd get a phone call from Peter or you know, any one of the guys, and I'd go down and, you know, pick a symbol best I could, sort of on what I was hearing and what they were looking for. And it was part of the job. You know, I never really sort of thought that much about it, and until years later when I started seeing other people saying, I've picked symbols for this guy. Oh, okay, well, that's what we used to do, you know.
Yeah, I always that was my one of my favorite parts of that when I had a symbol company was getting into the artist head, man. You know, like there's a lot of symbols out there, and you're gonna pick the ones that make them delight. You know, make them squeal, go, wow, that's just what I was looking for. That always felt great to me, and like, I was privileged to be able to do that. But you have to have
Well,
an ear.
you do, and I'll tell you one quick story. And I remember Earl Palmer early on when I started working there, and I think I'd met him maybe one time at the NAMM show. Maybe he had my card or something. And you know, Lenny was still there, and Lenny was still active and involved, but you know, kind of moving more toward education at that point. But I got a phone call from Earl looking for just sort of a straight up A medium ride. And I remember going down and kind of feeling a little bit, not nervous, but like, okay, shit, this is Earl Palmer, man. You know, I gotta make this count, you know. And I remember sending it to him and him calling me, and just he was another guy that was just the most amazing person on the planet. I mean, besides being the legendary drummer, you know, recording artist that he was. But he called and he was thanking me. And then I feel like in a Modern Drummer interview sometime after that, he mentioned it in there, which blew my mind, you know. He said, I've got this beautiful symbol that, you know, John DeChristopher picked out for me. And I thought, wow, man, Earl Palmer mentioned my
I know
name.
I've turned up in some thank yous in albums before, and I was just blown away by that. Or I used to like the trade shows because, you know, everybody sees everything, right? So you look around your booth and it's like, there's Peter Erskine and Lenny White and could be anybody. There's six or seven of them. Jim Keltner's there, and isn't that so and so? And didn't he play on this? And they're all in front of your booth listening to cymbals, you know. And it was such a friendly camaraderie, not only between the artist but the guy. I mean, you and I were friends and
Absolutely.
competitors, but I mean, I knew the people at Paiste, at Sabian, at the Turkish companies, and that was a big part of my life. I think it was for you too, right?
Absolutely was. I loved working with my friends in the industry. And you know, for example, you know, you mentioned the friendly competitor aspect, you and I, of course. You know, the Sabian, the Zildjian Sabian thing was a little different because of just the family element. But again, I knew Andy Zildjian before I worked for Zildjian. I met Andy when I worked for DW, and we were friends. And I later met Billy Zildjian when he was working for the company, and Bob. And so, you know, I always tried to keep a level of friendship and respect, although there were, you know, there were times when we all had to sort of get in each other's face about things. But
Every now and then you
Rich
fire a
mentioned,
shot over the other one's bow, but that's business. That's business. It's not personal.
that's right, exactly. And I was just gonna mention Rich Mangiacaro, who was still one of my best pals, and he, you know, was the Paiste artist director for years. And I remember we'd sometimes walk the show together, and people would see us and go, whoa, what are you guys doing? It was like we've known each other for 1,000 years. We're just shooting the shit, you know. We're
I
not
was in the
sharing
aisle
company
once.
secrets.
I was in the aisle once, and then I'm talking to Craigie, and Brock comes by from Remo, and he's like, "There you go, there you go. See?"
We
And
can
one
all
time I
work
was
together.
at Mesa in Germany, and this guy comes up and he's talking cymbals, and I realized he really knows what he's talking about. You know, some people really know their shit. You know what I'm talking about. And I have this wonderful conversation with him. I said, "Well, that's great talking to you, Michael. You really know a lot. What's your last name?" And he says, "Paiste." So,
He
well,
does know. He does know his shit.
yeah, he got it honest. Some of the other, like you also knew and worked with a lot of what you might call the present day legends, Vinny. These are one name guys too. Peter, Simon Phillips, Greg Bissonette, Dennis Chambers. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And I'm going at something with this. Where I'm going at is when you left Zildjian, just like when I left my thing, I realized that these were some of my favorite people in the world, and I knew them very personally. I knew their families, I knew their children, their wives, and sometimes their parents. And because I had left that part of the industry, I didn't want to leave that part of my life behind. These people mean a lot to me. So that's kind of why I started my little Drummer Nation show thing. And I got a feeling that's got something to do with your show.
Yeah, it does. And I totally get what you're saying. And I'll just say that, add to what you said, that that was definitely a concern when I left Zildjian. And I'll be honest with you, when I it's coming up to 10 years that I actually left the company. I gave my notice in October of 2012, and then the early part of October, and they asked me to not make any announcement for a couple of weeks just to sort of figure out what we were going to do. So when it was announced at the end of the month, my it's going to sound crazy and maybe full of myself, but my first feeling or reservation about it was, I don't want to let these guys down, like the guys that are used to dealing with me. And there were certainly people there behind me that they could work with and that they did end up working with. But but a guy like Steve Gadd or Peter or any number of the people that you mentioned were my regular contacts, or I was their contact, I should say. And I had it in my head that, I don't want them to feel that I'm leaving them in the lurches, which is, looking back, is kind of silly for me to think that I had any sort of that much influence on the whole thing. But to your point, 10 years later, every one of those people that you've mentioned, I'm still in regular contact with. I get, Steve Smith every couple of weeks will text me a picture of something, maybe at his lake house, and he'll say, he'll have like a vintage snare drum, and he'll go, "I'm just grooving here playing my old Black Beauty or something, and I thought of you," or something, because he knows I'm a vintage nut. Greg Bissonette will send me a little video clip of him and Ringo backstage before a gig, and he'd say, "I thought you'd get a," Ringo says hi, "I thought you'd get a kick out of this," and it's him and Ringo like doing some little funny bit for 30 seconds. And my point to all this, Michael, is 10 years later, I don't even feel the least bit disconnected, on top of doing my show. And that was another thing that I wanted to do during the pandemic, was to bring everybody together and just try to make what was at that time a really negative situation a positive situation. Let's not talk about that part of it too much, but let's all just, share some memories and have some laughs
Oh,
just have it be positive.
absolutely. Well, when the pandemic hit, I kept doing my interviews. Not, I don't know how many you've done, like 80, 90, something like that.
Close
Eventually,
to a
kind
hundred
of,
now, yeah.
yeah, I've done a couple of hundred, and eventually kind of hit a wall. And the COVID thing came, and I thought, I'm going to do a Zoom meeting on, I did it on Monday nights, and to keep track of this community of friends. And also, I wanted it to be private because I thought, if I really want to talk to these guys all the time, these are people that the general public pays money to access. You see what I'm saying? And so
Absolutely.
I had a couple of years there where on Monday night, you made a couple of them, people would drop in and there was no time they had to get there. They'd have to say they were coming, leave whenever they wanted. And there were about 50 or 60 drummers that floated through that. And I wasn't the only one doing that. There were some others like that. And it was kind of all supercharged by the pandemic.
I enjoy that. I wish I could have made more of those too. And they were a blast to do those with you. And I think the problem I had was they were, I think you did them at 8 o'clock Eastern
Well,
time, and
the thing
that's
is, whenever you did it, there were a lot of people who couldn't make it. So once it got going, you just sort of kept that thing rolling. And the other thing was, there was no recording, so it was just all guys hanging out at PASIC at the bar. And I treasure that. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about was the old guard industry folks. I'm going to mention some names here that I know you know, and I found the old guard guys were and women were very helpful and encouraging to me. And we're talking about Remo Belli, Vic Firth, Roy Burns, the Collados, Don Lombardi, Jim Catalano, Joe Hibbs, Jim Chapin, Freddie Gruber, you know all these guys.
All those guys. Yeah, I do. And gals. Yeah.
And gals. And that was the heart of the industry, man.
It was.
I talked to Phil Hood recently. He said, you know, he had Drum Magazine. And he said he went to the last NAMM show and he didn't know anybody. It
I
changes
kind of, you
very
know,
quickly, you know?
I know. I haven't been to an AMP show now in a few years.
Me neither.
And yeah, and you know, for the obvious reasons. And I definitely, I remember the last time I definitely saw more people that I didn't know than I did know. I mean, I made a point of seeing the people that I knew, and but there were definitely a lot of, and that's always going to happen. But you
It's
know,
the
I
way it should
remember,
be, right? Moves on.
yeah, as hard as we all worked at those shows. Yeah, that's right. And you know, we'd work hard at a NAMM show or at a PASIC convention, but the reward was hanging with all those people you just mentioned at night at the bar, you
Absolutely.
know. And
Absolutely.
yeah,
And I wouldn't
and
trade
I'd
that
add
for
Steve
anything.
Edelson to that list.
Oh,
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh,
exactly.
yeah, that's a short
Yeah,
list,
Steve.
but there's a lot of great ones.
Yeah,
Johnny
yeah.
Craviotto was a wonderful support for me and a
Yeah.
great guy. And
Yeah.
there's plenty of them. These were just off the top of my head.
Yeah,
Any
yeah.
of them more significant, maybe one or two that really were in your corner or you really felt close to?
Industry folks.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, you've definitely mentioned him, and I think, you know, we talked about Lenny. I mentioned Armin Zildjian. You know, all those. I worked, you know, I worked for Don Lombardi for 3 years, and that was my second job in the industry, and I learned so much working for him, and that really, I think, sort of put me on the map in the industry, so that when I moved back to the East Coast at the end of 1988. And I came out to Winter NAMM in '89. Zildjian approached me to work for them. I mean, they knew who I was from, you know, from being in the industry at that point for about 4 or 5 years. And you know, and that made me a more of a sort of a recognizable, known commodity, you could say. I mean, I think of all those people you mentioned, and you know, a couple others, guys like Sandy Feldstein, and you might have mentioned Lloyd McCausland, and
I didn't,
you
but
know,
sure, he's
yeah,
another one, yes.
Jim Catalano. You might have mentioned Jim, but you know, these are all Rick Drum. These are all the sort of guys when I was coming up in my early 20s and in the 80s. They were a few years older than me, and they'd been in the industry a few years, and I looked up to these guys. And I remember guys like Rick Drum and guys like Jim Catalano, being so giving and open to just, you know, it wasn't like I was kind of, you know, biting on their heels going, "Hey guys, can you show me what to do?" But you know, we'd be hanging out somewhere and they'd be like, "Hey, why don't you come along? We're gonna go see this guy play tonight if you want to come hang." And or just you'd just be hanging at the bar having a drink, and you'd just get into a conversation and realize that you had a lot more in common than you realized. You know, you might be a couple of years younger, but you're listening to the same drummers.
Sometimes you realize your best thing is to just shut up and listen good.
Oh yeah.
You
Yes.
know, because there's so much great information and character and just going by you, by the giants of the industry. I miss that. So at some point you began in becoming involved with, let's call it, producing, okay? And we can talk about what that means, but I know you did the Mission from GAD, several, those were like global tours, right? International tours.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And Zildjian days and things that were on video. And so you were executive producer a lot of those things, right?
Yes. Yeah. I my first time doing that, really taking that big a role, was the 2003 tribute to Steve Gadd that we did, the American Drummers Achievement Awards, and it was a tribute to Steve and to Armin Zildjian, and you know, the guys from Hudson Music recorded it, and they were producers with me, but it was, you know, my baby, so to speak. And it was a big deal. It was a huge deal. It was you know, it they'd
Very
say what
big. And you
doesn't
didn't
kill
have any
you
real
makes you
chops.
stronger.
You didn't have a lot of experience with that either, right?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I was, yeah.
Well, you nailed it, man. You stepped up. Now tell me
Thank you.
what does a producer do? I'm saying, hey, I'm
Well,
producing this. What does that mean?
I was responsible. I shouldn't say responsible. I was the one that organized the band, I should say bands that we had play between all the artists that came to support Steve and pay tribute. And that was the James Taylor Band. It was getting the talent like James Taylor himself and Paul Simon, managing the budget. There was a budget that I had to work with and adhere to, and figure out how many tickets we had to sell to make it all worthwhile, work out to pay everybody. Everybody did it for almost nothing, but we felt we had to pay the guys some sort of scale, something
Sure.
for their time and trouble, and coordinating the PR. We had a PR company coordinating rehearsal schedules in LA. And the drummers that we had paying tribute to Steve were Rick Marotta and Vinny Colaiuta. And I'll just give you one quick example of I realized coming down maybe a month or two before the event that Vinny was still working with Sting, and he was on tour with Sting, and he was going to finish the day before the event, or was it the day before maybe the rehearsal, but it was really close. He was going to be on a plane from London and arrive in Boston. And then the plan was, and he'd come right to Berkeley and be there. I guess it was for the gig. It was the gig day. And that was a scary thought, that if he missed the flight, if something happened, we'd have no Vinny. And he was a big part of this. So I contacted a drummer by the name of Dave DiCenzo. I'm sure you know Dave.
Absolutely, he's done my show.
He's done your show. Okay. And I
Oh yeah.
mentioned his dad earlier. And I said to Dave, I said, yeah, here's the situation. Vinny's going to do this, but if something were to happen, basically I asked him to be a sub standing by. And Dave was, at first sort of floored, and at the second, and like on the second point, he was like, thank you for thinking of me, and I won't let you down if you need me. And I knew he wouldn't. I knew he could read the shit cold and just come in there and kill it. And sure enough, Vinny arrived on time. It was fine. It had his drum set up for him, and it took like 5 minutes for him to get ready to go, and we it all went according to plan. But Dave was there in the event that something happened, and he would have pulled it off,
I was
but it
that
was.
guy once. I got called. West Side Story is a pretty hard show, and the Atlanta Ballet or somebody was doing it in town. And
Oh yeah.
the drummer, as a friend of mine, said, "Well, dress rehearsal, I think I'm going to be a little late. Can you just learn the overture?" And of course, the overture is everything in the show, right? And it's hard shit. So I said, "Well, okay." So I show up for the overture. I show up for the dress rehearsal, and the guys in the band are, "What are you doing here?" So, well, he's going to be a little late, maybe. So they bring down the high slides, and he shows up. Okay, fine, I'm off the hook. Next night's opening night. Opening night, West Side Story. I haven't played a note with these people. And the house lights come down, the conductor walks out, he gets on the podium, they put the light on him, and he's about to raise his baton, and the guy shows up. I was like, oh shit, thank you very much. Your
That's
first thing
cutting
is you're,
it close.
yeah, you're scared to do, what? Sure, I'll do it. And then you really go, man, what did I get myself into? But back to the producing thing, I didn't know what a producer was till I had to do it too. And it's really the guy who, or woman, we say guy, who puts the whole thing together, right? The money, the talent, the budget, the logistics, the food, the location, everything. And if anything goes wrong, it's on you.
Exactly. I was going to say that. You get, none of the credit and all the blame.
That's right. I
But
used to love at NAMM, I loved turning in the rental car because I knew that was the last responsibility I had. After that, the airline's going to get me home. That's on them.
Exactly. Oh, that's well. I'll tell you quick. So we did
Yeah,
the Steve
please,
Gadd
anything.
event at Berkeley, and it came off perfectly. It was great. But what I remember too is not being able to remember anything, because as you say, as the producer, I was standing side stage all night with headphones and with my notes, and basically calling and saying, okay, Willie, we need you now, and Vinny, we need you standing by, and let's get this ready to go, and then we're going to bring out Louis Belson to talk. And I watched it a couple of times, and it's I'm really impressed, or that's maybe not the right word, but honored that I was a big part of that. But it's funny watching it and going like, I kind of don't even really remember this. It just happened, went by so fast, and then 5 years later, in 2008, we did a show to pay tribute to Ginger Baker, and that was in London. And leading up to that, I was going to London for the 2 years before that. Every couple of months, we'd go out and be scouting locations. We were talking to sponsors. I was talking to Charlie about being honored as well, and Ringo, and Mitch Mitchell. We were looking at trying to, honor several people, and it just, for a variety of reasons, it didn't all sort of pan out. But we did honor Ginger. And the night of the event, now leading up to it, we had Jack Bruce there. We had Simon Phillips. We had Tony Levin. We had Steve White. We had Keith Carlock. Gary Husband was playing keyboards in the band. It was this phenomenal lineup of musicians. Tony Allen. And the day of the event, we'd finished sound check. I go back to the hotel, and there's a knock on my door. And I thought it was Brad Baker bringing me a ticket for my wife. Brad had said something like, I'll run a ticket up to your room for you in a little while for Kelly or something. And
Yeah, I knew
I
Brad,
hear
yeah.
this, Brad, yeah. And I hear this really loud pounding on my door. And I'm like, geez, that's not like Brad to do that, I open the door and it's Ginger. He's standing there looking at me. And I had just come out of the shower. I had no shirt on. He puts his face right up to my face and he said, "They want to throw me out. Talk to them." And he steps aside, and behind him is the hotel manager and a woman. And I went, "Can I help you?" And he said, "Sir, he's disturbing the other guests and making a racket, and we want him out of the hotel." And just as he's saying this, Craigie Zildjian is walking down the hall right by my room, because I'm to meet Craigie in the lobby in 10 minutes to go over to the venue. And she stops and says, "What's going on?" I said, "Just keep walking, keep walking. Nothing to see here. Just keep walking." And she had this look like, "What's going on?" I said,
Okay.
"Craigie, it's okay. Just keep." So I pleaded with this guy to please let Ginger stay. And I said, Ginger had left at that point. I said, "Please, we're honoring him tonight." He said, "I know all about it." I said, "If you can just, I'll if I get him out of the hotel now, can he stay the night? And then we're all leaving tomorrow." And he said, "Fine." But so then I got dressed and went downstairs. I bumped into the same manager again, and he said, "Is he gone?" And I said, "He's not yet." I said, "I'm going to meet him." And I called Ginger's room, and he answered the phone, which was great because I was afraid I wouldn't be able to find him. But I said, "Ginger, how about we just head over to the venue now, and we get out of the hotel?" And he said, "Fine, fine. I'll see you down there." And there he was when I got down there, and we drove over. We had a nice chat. And I put him in his dressing room, and now Charlie Watts was there to present the award to Ginger. He agreed to do that as a favor, and Charlie showed up at 7 on the dot, just like he said he would. So great that he comes in this beautiful, like white, crisp white shirt with a black suit,
Immaculate, yeah.
immaculate. He looked fantastic, and he said hello to everybody, and I said, "Yeah, Ginger's in his dressing room if you want to come say hello." And he said, "Yeah, let me come say hello." And he sat with Ginger for like a half an hour, and they told stories and they laughed. And Charlie at one point said to me, "I should probably go say hi to Jack and Simon and all the guys, and I'll see you in a little bit." So he leaves, and Ginger turns to me and says, "Thanks, John. Charlie's a great guy. He's a great guy." And he was better at that point. Everything was cool. And we got through the night. And I told Charlie later, I said, "You have no idea just what the calming presence you had on Ginger. He just, I think he was having a little disagreement with his lady friend, and it just, kind of escalated to him getting noisy and all that stuff." But rest his soul, Ginger was a great person. He gets a little bit of a reputation, but I knew him, and he was always so kind to me.
Well, I think a lot of that's a great story. Thank you. I think a lot of these artists who are known to be pieces of work, shall we say, are really genuine human beings. And if you
Yeah.
show them the right respect and you don't challenge them on things that they don't want to be challenged on. We've all had our share of artists like that, and I always found once you got to know them, they were fine.
Well said. That's exactly right. Yeah, exactly right.
If you had the right respect, if you knew who they were and valued what they did and their contributions to music at large. When you were producing those things, now you have a show. Plug your show. What's it called?
It's called Live From My Drum Room, with John DeChristopher, or John DeChristopher Live From My Drum Room. I forget what I ended up with as far as the title. And it's also the Modern Drummer podcast. And earlier this year, my old friend David Frangione, who's the CEO and publisher at MD, we go back, gosh, a long time, both Boston guys, and he's a few years younger than me, and used to come into Wurlitzer when I worked there. I was like 20, and he was probably like 16, and bought equipment for me, and then years later at another shop that I worked at. So David now, of course, is running the magazine, owns the magazine, and had been watching the show and contacted me and said, "I'd love to have your show be the Modern Drummer podcast." So we got on the phone a couple of times, and we put our heads together and came up with an agreement that allows me to basically, license my shows to Modern Drummer. So I still own them, and I'm getting, kind of a bigger footprint, you could say, by MD having it. But I'm still putting these up on my YouTube channel and podcast platforms as well. So,
Well, excellent, and congratulations. This is something
thank you.
I've thought should be the way it goes for quite some time now. And I do something similar. Most of my action's on Facebook, so I cross post to people who allow me to do so in exchange for some spots I run on them. And that way I get, let's face it, we talked about how small this thing is. I get a couple thousand hits on each one. And I try to remember how small it is and the fact that if those four people were all in the same room, it would feel like a giant crowd.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And
And the other thing, go ahead, I'm sorry.
no, I was just gonna say, that was, I never got into this thing, for the money. It's just to just keep the message out there and keep it positive. And
When somebody like Ed So says, "Michael, I think your interviews belong in the Smithsonian," that makes me feel really good. And the other thing.